Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Blaser from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you this week. We're returning to a very popular topic of mine, and that is the horror genre. For those of you who are longtime listeners of the cast, you probably remember our Halloween horror-themed cast. I think that was 2013, maybe 2014, one of those two. And it's been quite a long time since we've talked about horror, especially with the rise of the Five Nights at Freddy's series and this new transition into jump scareville territory there. But before we get going, let's introduce our guest tonight. First, joining me again as co-host for the cast, please welcome James Ellerby.
Hi, guys.
James, it's great to have you back on. I know this week we've been doing a live recording. It's always weird when we record these things like a week or two in advance, because the people listening don't know how many times we actually do these podcasts.
Yeah, it's been a busy week for us.
Yeah. And also joining us tonight, he is the creative director behind the horror game When Winds Bloom. Please welcome George.
Hi.
Hey, George, it's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. We were talking about this on Twitter and through email before the cast, but I know you're also very interested in the horror genre, obviously working on your own horror game at the moment.
Oh, yes, I'm extremely interested. Yeah.
And it's kind of weird talking about the horror genre because we could probably have an entire cast dedicated to film as much as we could have it dedicated to the video game industry.
Yeah, certainly.
So before we get to the horror side of this cast, since this is your first time on, could you tell everyone listening a little bit about yourself, you know, the games you like to play, and a little bit about the game you're working on?
So I'm the creative director at Mute Canary. And we're working on a horror game called When Winds Bloom, which is like a sort of dark fantasy horror type of game. I enjoy playing horror games in general, starting back with Resident Evil and watching my cousins playing it as a little kid and getting scared, terrified actually, but enjoying it and moving on from there to Silent Hill and all the rest of the big ones. But I enjoy playing almost everything. I don't really have a particular genre I stick to with video games. But I particularly love the horror genre in general. For our first game, we decided to stick to that and make something like that, especially since it's so popular nowadays.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird to talk about the horror genres being popular. Obviously, as a fan of the horror, of video game horror games, I'm sure you remember when one of the directors behind, I think it was Resident Evil Revelation, said like survival horror was no longer viable in the game industry. And sort of like how the horror genre was starting to go away. I think it was like mid-thousands.
Yeah, it was. There was kind of like a drought, and it's kind of ironic too because now they're coming back to life. They were dead, and they're coming back like zombies.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, and it's interesting about that, George. Like, it really is coming back to life. And before I ask you a little bit more about your taste with horror and a little bit more about When Winds Bloom, for you, James, since this is your first time on like a horror-themed cast, I just want to get your, I guess, your overall take. Like, are you a fan of the horror genre? Are there any horror games you particularly like? Stuff like that.
I didn't get a chance to. I only played like the demo of Resident Evil 7. The first But I was a huge fan of Silent Hill. Silent Hill is probably my first introduction to horror. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see, again, how things have really transitioned. I've made multiple posts on Game Wisdom regarding the horror genre, the psychology of playing these games, fight versus fright, that kind of stuff. Going back to the older casts, I still remember saying that when I was younger, I was just horrible with horror. Like, every little thing scared me. I couldn't play these games. I couldn't watch any movies. And then, like, right around like the early thousands, maybe like mid thousand, all of a sudden like my fear just like disappeared. Now I can like play all these horror games, not bad. And the Five Nights at Freddy's series like actually makes me tired when I play them. I mean, just the other night I can watch like Hellraiser and it doesn't even bother me. I'm just like up at night like that.
Well, I also, it's funny that you mentioned that because I remember as a child, I was also like really terrified of horror films and my uncle would like put them on as a, just like kind of like a joke or something. And I would run over and like hide in the, under the kitchen table. But then one night I actually just like stayed and I was like adamant. I was like, put it on. I want to see it. And I just forced myself to like look at the screen. And when I did that, there wasn't anything really terrifying being shown. It was very much so like just scary in your head when you just sort of think about the concept of it.
Yeah.
But the, those films, they never really show much gratuity in terms of horror. I mean, there's like gore, gratuitous gore. Definitely. But that doesn't really shock, you know.
Yeah, and there's only so much gore can really impact you. And some of like the best horror movies know like just how to properly pace that out. Because again, if you're just in like the first 10 minutes, if the whole screen is just covered in blood, how are you going to sustain that over like the next 80 minutes or so of a movie?
Yeah, and they also choreograph it too. Like you see it coming. And that's sort of like a, almost like a warning to cover your eyes. Mm-hmm. But in these video games that we're seeing now, there is no real warning. And that's kind of why it's sort of these shocking, scary moments. Mm-hmm. Where they're actually almost scarier than the films, horror films.
Yeah, and I definitely want to talk more about Five Nights at Freddy's and sort of this new generation of horror. Before we get to that, I guess just talking a little bit more about the horror genre in general.
Yeah.
This next question I think is going to be before both of you. And that is, obviously, three of us, we grew up watching these horror games, watching the movies, and sort of seeing how things have transitioned. Now, obviously, three of us, we know about Resident Evil, Silent Hill, the mid-90s, early 2000s era of horror. The first, like, major transition from horror probably came with Resident Evil 4, which was then dubbed, quote-unquote, action horror. And this is when the horror genre sort of adopted more of a third-person shooter feel to it. There was, of course, Dead Space, Resident Evil 5 and 6, and more games that I'm most likely forgetting off the top of my head right now. So, the actual question for both of you, then, is when the horror genre transitioned to action, what were your takes on this? And we'll start with George this time.
Well, with Resident Evil 4, I was really excited because that one struck a perfect balance, I think. But soon after that, they definitely went overboard with the action and just completely ignored the horror elements. Because with action, you're almost overpowered, you know? Mm-hmm. It's a power trip. And that is the antithesis of horror.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just in the same way, like, horror comedies can work, horror action can work, too. But you just have to strike that balance. You can't ignore one and do all of the other, you know?
Yeah. And I want to definitely expand on that in a second. But for you, James, what were your thoughts on this transition to action horror?
This is going to sound weird because probably one of the few gamers. I did not get a chance to actually play Resident Evil 4. I know I've seen people play it and whatnot. I never got a chance to experience it for myself, which is kind of weird because I know looking back at it now, and I have, I mean, it's not like I haven't, you know, seen people play it and had, you know, been fully enthralled in the game. I just never got a chance to actually sit down and play it all the way through myself. But, like, it's, you're right, I do have to agree there. It's like when you give too much power, it stops becoming fun. Like, when a monster can be truly beaten, is it really a monster anymore? You know what I mean? It's one of those differences. It's one of those things that a dragon isn't considered a horror monster because dragons ultimately are always supposed to be beaten, always supposed to be fought, always supposed to be overcome, which kind of removes them from the horror genre of monster. And I think striking that balance, and even more so, and maybe not even just balancing it, but even leaning more towards the fact that there are monsters and creatures that you can't kill, I think would definitely help add more to the action. Help add more to the action horror dump.
Yeah. And that's a really good point. And what I also want to expand on with what George was just saying, the problem with the action horror genre, at least what we saw with the Resident Evil Dead Space era, was again that it just felt like they were missing the point of horror. When you're able to just go around and blast these enemies, it's not really horror. You're just playing an action game with scary creatures. Or not even scary, because when you have a rocket launcher, it's hard to be scared. It's sort of the what the game developers are trying to do with action horror and failed is what I think the recent Doom got right with trying to present an action game. When you look at Doom 2016, it is action through and through. Yes, it takes place in hell, there's monsters, but it was built around that power fantasy. So you're not supposed to be a terrified person, you know, walking slowly in the dark hoping nothing attacks you. You're the guy running around with a super shotgun ripping imps apart.
Yeah, you're kicking in the door.
Yeah, you're not the guy hiding. And that was, I think, one of the major points with the action horror genre where it started to lose itself. Now, the first Resident Evil 4, to be fair, I thought it did strike a really good balance. You had weapons, but you were always going to be outnumbered. And I think they really got like the enemy designs right in that game.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also like the movement was really important to making that really scary because you had to stop and shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're just coming all, like closer and closer towards you as you're trying to take aim. So that's what really made it scary, I think.
Yeah. And talking about, again, having like the right protagonist for horror and how you can still have someone who's considered strong, I always use this example, and it's still my go-to example of all these years, but I really liked Evil Dead 2. And have you guys seen it? I know this may be a dumb question.
I love that movie.
Yeah. What about you, James?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, one of my favorite parts of Evil Dead 2 comes near the end of the movie when Ash has to go down to the cellar and get the pages of the Necronomicon. And I've used this example, I know for those of you listening, this is a time to take a shot if you have a drink ready. But he goes down to the cellar, he has a shotgun in one hand, he has his chainsaw on the other. And if this was an action game, this would be, you know, the moment where, you know, the heavy metal music starts, you know, this is where the action kicks in, that kind of thing. And instead, they play it for complete terror. He is completely terrified despite having all these weapons in his hands. And again, the camera, it's all slow, very deliberate. I just thought that was just a really great example of giving you a protagonist who is armed, but at the same time is still absolutely terrified about what's going to happen. Now, with the horror genre in general, then, actually, what you were just saying, George, regarding Resident Evil 4, that actually takes me to my next question I want to ask both of you. One of the things about the horror genre, especially the early thousands to before, was about a very deliberate or explicit design. Raise your hand, for those of you listening, if you played a horror game with tank-like controls. Silent Hill, Resident Evil, etc. Even, like, the more quote-unquote modern horror games like Haunting Ground, Clock Tower series, and stuff like that also feature those controls. And they were designed explicitly, again, to force a player into a situation where they're not going to be strong. It's very hard to fight an enemy when you have to stop and, you know, manually turn your guy, get it to hopefully hit the guy before he gets to you. And we all experienced the Resident Evil aim the shotgun up at the zombie's head trick. So my question for both of you, and this time we'll start with you, James, is that kind of deliberate control scheme and design, did you enjoy that? And do you think that added to the game, or do you think it distracted from it?
Me personally, I think it. I think it kind of distracted from distracted from it, and it distracted because it wasn't a feeling of helplessness that was organic. It was a feeling of helplessness that came outside. You could tell it was one of those, like, especially for the old Resident, for the original Resident Evil, and or more specifically, Silent Hill games. it was the game. That's just, you know, I think they had some control over it, but there was a lot of, you know, I mean, if you read a lot about the original Silent Hill, one of the reasons why the town's in a fog is because of the loading. It just, they couldn't load all this town that fast. So they kept that they kept the fog in there so that we wouldn't see it loading. And it added to the mystery. And now that's an example of the actual mechanics of the game, mechanical limitations of the game, adding to the horror franchise. But when I just have to, you know, use like tank-like controls just to shoot a zombie, it's not because I have few bullets. It's not because the zombie's coming at me. It's, oh wow, it's the controls that aren't, it doesn't make it any more fun. I'm not enjoying the horror of the game. I'm getting angry at the horror of the controls.
Yeah.
See, I'm on the flip side of that. I thought that actually like really made it balanced and made it scary, because you can run in the game, and so the zombies move very, very slowly. I know that there's dogs that also move really fast, but for the most part, you're fighting the zombies. And so like it really keeps it balanced with the hindrance of movement. But at the same time, though, I know that like I'm in the minority of that that actually is in favor of tank controls. And so with the game I'm working on, I ended up like making like three or four different control schemes, like different settings you can do with the options, because I'm not sure. I know that like somebody's going to review it and be like, oh, I hate tank controls and stuff. So I'm like trying to strike a balance. But it's very hard to design then the enemies and the movement speeds when you have that level of options for the player to change that, because that's so integral to the mechanics of the game.
Definitely. And that balance, again, between action and horror is such a difficult point to pull off. It's why a lot, again, the most memorable horror games try to downplay the action, I think, for more puzzle solving or more exploration. Good example would be like the original Alone in the Dark, which the combat was, again, a very weird, awkward system, but it was more focused about, I think, the adventure side of things, with the puzzle solving and trying to find the items to help you. A good horror game that I sort of liked was Alan Wake, which came out a few years ago, which also tried, again, to balance horror with action. So, despite being a writer, Alan Wake was basically a one-man army killing all these creatures and, you know, using guns and shotguns and all that stuff. And I think when you're trying to design the horror game, it is very tricky to just figure out how much do I want to give the player? Like, what essentially is the player's limits? Can he, going back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, James, like, is every monster in this game defeatable? Can the guy just walk up to, like, your biggest boss with a shotgun and kill him in two hits? And if you're not careful about that kind of balance, you'll either make a action game that completely misses the point of horror, or you'll make a horror game that's just too unwieldy to play. And I agree with you, James, that when I play a lot of these older horror games with those tank-like controls, I'm more distracted by the controls than I am about being scared by the game. And it's actually a good tangent to talk more about the jump scare focus games, which we'll come back to later in this cast.
Well, and honestly, to tell you the truth, I wouldn't have a problem with the bad controls if there was an in-game storyline reason for why I couldn't move my controller that fast, or why it was being done. Like, now this isn't a horror game, but it was a very horrifying part when in the Metal Gear Solid, the one for the PlayStation, is that Metal Gear Solid 2? The one for the PlayStation 1.
PlayStation 1, I think, was the original Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah, the first one.
Yeah. And where you're fighting Psycho Mantis,
yeah,
and he starts reading your controls, and your controls start freaking out. Like, it's like I'm trying to, and there was a story reason behind it, which made me even more scared, because it made me think that there was something outside of the story Like, it was one of those, it was a perfect blend of horror in which the storyline gave you a reason to be afraid of outside of the story. Like, you're like, wait, why are my controls messed up? And you're thinking to yourself, well, okay, is my thing plugged in? Because that was back when you actually had to plug the controller in. You're like, is my thing plugged in correctly? I'm like, yeah, no, it's fine. I know all of your moves. I know all of your moves. And you're like, you know, it didn't break the game because the guy in the game was telling you what was going on and gave you a reason as to why the controls were the way they were. You know what I mean? It's one of those things like there are certain like zombie survival games that are going on now where if you get a broken leg, you can't move your character as fast. You know what I mean? And that's not the controller's wrong. It's the story of the game telling you, well, you can't do this, or you're at a limited capacity, or, you know, your power is limited because so-and-so story.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I think it's also very interesting that you brought up the point with Psycho Mantis. He also, like, expanded the frame of the game. Like, you're thinking of the controls and the game, and that's it. That's the game space. But he is taking into account the controller port that you're actually plugged into and everything. So he's expanding the game space, and that's what really also, like, made it more interesting and more real and scary.
And that was scary. It was a horrifying moment. You're like, how is this dude doing this?
Yeah. And I think what you were just saying, James, is another really good point about that it's better if there is an in-game or a lore explanation for what's going on. And I think that's another reason why a lot of the horror games, especially those that came out from like the mid-90s to mid-thousands, feature the quote-unquote the average Joe. You know, the person, the husband, the wife, the teenage girl. Characters who aren't supposed to be, you know, SWAT, trained, Navy SEAL, badass with every gun kind of thing. And they were trying to rationalize that, but I think can only go so far. Because even like a 13-year-old girl would know you don't spend 5 minutes having to turn yourself around in order to run in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Now, before we talk, again, we could, I don't even know how long we could probably talk about general horror, but to sort of break things up and move the cast along, let's talk a little bit more about your game, George, and a little bit and more about like what kind of horror you're trying to, I guess, instill in the player.
Yeah, I'm trying to go back to the old school Resident Evil Silent Hill type of survival horror with it and make it more classic like that, like with a fixed camera angles, but I'm also trying to bring in some more modern touches to it, so there's going to be some like first person and third person elements too, so basically like all the like, different camera schemes to think of. I spent a long time developing a very malleable camera system for that, so I got that going, but I really am opposed to the sort of jump scare trend that we're seeing now. So I'm trying to like keep the atmosphere and the dread of the old school, because I feel like those types of things are much more harder to pull off. They take some skill and finesse, and they really draw the player in rather than make it more of like a, I don't know, some sort of like entertainment show. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, George. And again, like with a lot of the older horror games, like on the site on Game Wisdom, I actually have a design document that I wrote about what would be like my dream horror game. So I like one like somewhere I just thought about how would I scare myself? I basically turned that into a design document, and that would be one of my dream games if I ever had the chance I would love to make. And you are right about the fact that it's very hard to get away from the jump scare style of things, because that's what I think a lot of people could first think about with horror. But fans of the horror genre know that it's about the tension. It's about the build-up and the release that really makes the best horror movies and, by proxy, the best horror games. Like, again, like the original Resident Evil, you're stuck in this mansion all by yourself. And yes, it did have a few jump scares, but it was about building that tension of you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And Another really good game that I think also did that would be the Fatal Frame series. Have you guys played or heard of those?
Yes, I love those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Fatal Frame, I've said this again before, but Fatal Frame 3, that's the game that basically scared the horror out of me. That game just freaked the crap out of me back in the early 2000s. And then after that, I was like, nothing else can match up. I'm cured.
Well, yeah, I remember playing the second one, and the second one was just the most enjoyable thing. The third one, I never actually finished that one. It didn't scare me too much, but like I don't know, I just never got around to finishing it. But The second one was actually one of my favorite horror games in general. Yeah.
And I also brought up, because I know with your game, you were talking about the third-person camera or the still camera or the, I'm sorry, the fixed camera and the first-person camera, and the Fatal Frame series made heavy use of that with their games and their design.
Yeah, and that was actually how you fought the ghosts, was going into first-person and trying to find them and snap a picture of them. Mm-hmm. So I like that. It sort of pulls you in, and you really do feel like you're holding up a camera to this thing. And your field of vision is much more narrow, too. Like, when you think of first person, you think, oh, I can see, like, everything. But with that one, it had, like, just a small frame to see stuff with. Mm-hmm. And on the bottom, you had, like, a bar that showed the power level of your attack, I guess, when you timed the shooting of the camera. But so it's interesting because it actually took away the advantage you would have even just going into first person. It was always limiting you. It was always like trying to, you know, make you weaker, even though it gave you some strength.
Yeah, and that game also did balance, like, you had the ghosts that you could kill, and then there were situations where you couldn't fight this thing. You just had to get the hell away from them.
Yeah, and that was scary too, because they could like go through walls and they would phase in and out. You couldn't really see them sometimes.
Yeah, and this is a story I always like to bring up, but the first time I played Fatal Frame 3, I was trying out at GameStop where they didn't have the sound on. So I'm just like standing there playing it, and the ghost, because I had no sound, I couldn't hear when they were coming. The ghost literally came out of the ground from my character, and I jumped in the store. I literally just like jumped back 3 feet from the game, and everyone like turned around and looked at me like, what the hell is wrong with that guy?
Well, that's really something, because sound is so important to horror. Like, we think about it, that, you know, that the like high-pitched squeal of a violin or something, or like a really disturbing sound, but it's amazing when it works without that.
Yeah, but of course the classic Silent Hill, the radio starting to go off.
Yes, kind of thing. The static. Mm-hmm. Oh my god. Still sends chills down my spine.
Yeah, Silent Hill probably made a whole generation of people afraid to ever go into schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings ever again. Now, going back to your game, in terms of, like, as we said, with, like, combat and, like, the action side of things, are you giving, like, the player, I guess, quote-unquote, power in that sense? Or will, or, like, are the threats, like, unable to be beaten, I guess?
I know I'm going to have some threats that are just completely unable to be beaten. I'm debating whether or not giving you some level of power to sort of at least trap them or send them away temporarily. For example, you'll have a doll that you can sort of go into first person and hold up in front of the monster and sort of like hide behind it. Mm-hmm. And that will make the monster disappear after a while. That's just one idea. That's just one already implemented a sort of defense that you'll have. But like with that, it's like very much almost like this Fatal Frame mechanic where you're sort of planted in first person, so you can't really move. You have to play off that, like, do I want to run and escape, or do I stay on my ground and try and fight this?
Yeah.
Which I think is an interesting choice to make. Yeah,
yeah, and I agree with you completely on that, George. One of my more popular pieces where I talk about fight versus flight, I think that is a major component of good horror. If the player just has no options whatsoever, I think it just really downplays the horror. And goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with the jump scare focus. If you know every time you see the monster, there's nothing you can do, you're going to die, it sort of means that, I think the game becomes very repetitive after a while, and it kind of drove me nuts in Amnesia, The Dark Descent.
Oh, that was the worst. Yeah.
Thank you. Someone else said that.
Well, it's like, I remember playing it, and by the second or third level, I was completely phased from it. Like, mm-hmm. Especially since when you die, you just respawn,
yeah,
and the monsters are gone. Like, there's no penalty for dying. It actually encourages you to die, yeah, then, because it's just, then there's no challenge left. You can just explore the empty environment.
Yep, and there was no options for dealing with these monsters. You just, they saw you, like, the time it takes you to run away and hide, it's just quicker just to, like, stand there and let them beat the crap out of you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. When I heard the scream and, like, the thing was coming, I just let go of the mouse and just let it
yeah,
do its thing, you know?
Now, I will say, to give them credit, the parts where you're fighting, like, the invisible water monster, where you're trying to get through, like, the water sections, I thought that was very well done.
Yeah, but that one, you weren't really fighting them. You were kind of just navigating around them. Mm-hmm. And I remember actually dying a few times there in that, too. I think the water monster, I think, also disappears if you die there a couple times.
Yeah, I don't remember. It's been too long.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
Now, there is one point about Amnesia that I want to bring up, but I also want to touch on this one point you were just saying regarding having, like, a defensive item in your game.
Yeah.
And I think that's another key point about horror and, like, the horror genre in general, is the difference between a defensive option and an offensive option. When you play, going back to, like, the Resident Evil, Silent Hill, and Dead Space, your options were offensive. You were meant to hunt these enemies down. When you get your shotgun in Resident Evil, it's no longer about you, you know, walking around being slow. It's about you approaching these guys and going, you know, heads up, boom, you're dead. And defensive options, I think, are different. It still gives you that option, but it's less about you trying to still actively engage or actively hunt these guys. It's more about just having something to use when the shit hits the fan. Going back to Alan Wake, for instance, one of my favorite items in that game were the use of the survival flares. And they did was you had limited stock, and when you lay a flare, enemies will not engage you. They'll still, like, try to get at you, but you basically have about, I think it was like 3 to 5 seconds of cover, in a sense. And I thought that was just a very interesting mechanic, because there were cases where the enemies would just infinitely respawn, so your only options were to run away. And that was just a great use of this defense mechanic to say, okay, you can be invulnerable, but we're only going to give you, like, 5 shots of it. And once you run out, you got nothing else to defend yourself with.
Yeah, I think a big component of that game was running, too. A lot of that game was moving really fast and just, like, trying to get away. So that just sort of, like, gave you a heads up, a head start, I mean. And that was really useful. And I loved that whole aspect to it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, again, I really liked about Alan Wake and how they try to play, again, the action and the horror together. Because there were cases where you were just going to run around, you know, shooting enemies with your shotgun and giving, like, the flare gun, turning into, like, some little, like, mini nuke weapon. One other aspect that I want to touch on with Alan Wake before we go back to Amnesia and my other example, I thought the downloadable chapters that came after the game was released were the best parts of Alan Wake, when you're stuck in, like, the nightmare world. What did you think about that, or did you have a chance to look at that?
I vaguely remember the one, and it was almost like a King of the Hill style type of thing, right? Or no?
I think you were thinking of American Nightmare, which
came.
Before that, they released 2 downloadable episodes of the original Alan Wake. I think it was called The Author and The Signal. And it took place after the end of Alan Wake, when he's stuck inside, like, whatever, like, the nightmarish force was. And so it was just all about, like, exploring someplace that was not reality. So, like, the walls would shift, things were not what they seemed.
Yeah.
And
I definitely did play that, and I love that sort of surreal aspect.
Yeah.
I like surreality in the horror, I feel like the unnatural and the unknown is hugely terrifying.
Yeah. definitely. Yeah. That's what I think we can all agree. I think that's one of the things I was really saw about Silent Hill was when you make that transition to the quote unquote other Silent Hill, and the whole place just shifts and warps around you.
Yeah, that's definitely the most terrifying part.
Mm-hmm.
Because anything can happen. Like you, like almost what you said about Resident Evil with the mansion. That mansion isn't really realistic. Like, you know, those statues, those puzzles don't really make much sense when you really think about it. So there's always that element of like, well, what can happen next? Like, you don't know what you're going to find. So even with that, even in like a realistic setting, there's still that weird, surreal element to it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Now, going back to Amnesia, I think actually, before I bring up the Amnesia example, I want to talk a little bit more about your game, George, before we sort of transition more into, I guess, the state of modern horror. So, I just want to make sure I got the title right. It's When Wind Blooms?
When Wounds Bloom. When Wounds Bloom. Like flowers bloom. Okay. When Wounds Bloom.
Got it. Yeah. With When Wounds Bloom, another part of the horror genre has to be pacing, like how long you're aiming the game to be. We've seen, like, with Alien Isolation, which was a really good example of horror with something you can't kill, a lot of people complain that it was too long. Like, when you get to, like, the 8 to 10 hour mark, it's the same problem we see with a lot of movies, that getting that timing and the pace of the movie right is very tricky. With When Wounds Bloom, are you looking to make, like, a shorter experience, longer, or is it still, like, I guess, in flux at the moment?
It's a bit in flux, but I have the general structure of, like, I want to break it down into basically, like, sort of chapters. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a certain rhythm to it where you start off in your bedroom, you solve some puzzles, and then you go into the forest world. And the forest world is sort of, like, akin towards, like, the other side of Silent Hill or something like that, the nightmare world. Mm-hmm. And so that's when things get really terrifying. And then you reach a climax and you come back to the room and you start the next chapter. So there's this rhythm to it where those sections will last about like an hour at a time. So you never get really too tired or exhausted by staying in like a hypertension mode for too long.
Yeah. So there is like that sense of rhythm between safety and terror. Again, I think Fatal Frame 3 also did a good job of that. But what you were just saying regarding having these, like, quote-unquote chapters, I think that's a very interesting element we started to see with more modern horror games. I know The Evil Within also was set up as, like, a chapter format. Even Alan Wake, it was set up as, like, episodes in a TV show.
Yeah. Alone in the Dark, I think, also did that.
Yeah.
They even said, like, season one or whatever, and it's like set up where you can actually select the different episodes as if you're going through like a Netflix playlist or something.
Yeah. And I think that's another useful trick for horror games to like be set up like that. Again, when you can establish these periods of tension and safety, and then you can start to mess around with them or alter things as well. With Fatal Frame 3, I don't know how far you got, but they started to mess with your quote-unquote safe haven section. And it got, like, that's another part in Fatal Frame 3 that it basically almost gave me a heart attack when that happened, because I was not... that's just a really good semi-tangent. Some of the best horror, most memorable horror sections for me is when the game gets me. Like, I'm not expecting it at all. Like, you know, my guard is completely down, and the game, you know, hits me just right.
When they take pulls on you.
Mm-hmm. When I play...
Sorry. I was just going to say, like, that reminds me of, like, in Silent Hill 4, when your apartment that you would come back to, and it would be cursed after a while, and it's strange, like, ghostly things would just come out of the walls and stuff. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, in the game Duskers that came out a few months ago, which was a roguelike programming/horror game, I was doing a live stream of it, and I was going, okay, so the thing must be dead. We'll open up the door, and as soon as I open the door, the thing like jumps through, and I had to like stop for a second because my R just, it got me completely. And I think everyone like her, I was like, oh, like, hold on, I think my heart just stopped. Give me like a minute, folks. Someone call 911. There's a problem here. But, like, I think that's when it works. And in order to have that, you need to have pacing. As you were just saying, George, when things are always on, there's just no buildup. When you're always expecting something to pop out, the player can never let down their guard. And that's when things become very repetitive and one note. Similar to, like, Amnesia again, and even with the action horror genre. When I'm always on edge, there's nowhere else for me to go, kind of.
Exactly. I think that was the main problem with Dead Space, the first Dead Space. It was way too much of that. Like, you would always see something popping out of a grating, and then there'd be just like a shooting fest going on. So that was a huge issue. And then also with the Alien game, I think that you're always tense and expecting it to pop out, but it almost felt like then you were basically playing with a jack in the box. You're just turning the handle and waiting for it to pop out.
Yeah. And even going back to Silent Hill, they, I think, did a good job of, again, pacing things out, because you do return from the other Silent Hill multiple times throughout the game. And that's sort of like the game's way of saying, okay, you know, take a deep breath. We can relax for a minute. And then again, that buildup starts again. It's like, okay, I'm back normal, but when is that shift going to happen again?
Yeah. And it can happen at any time, because it's so surreal and unexpected sort of environment that anything can happen.
Yeah. And the environment, I think, is such a key part of making a good horror game. As we've said, it has to, when you're dealing with the surreal, when things aren't what they seem, and you know, you have just no idea what's going on, it does add to the horror. And as a slight tangent, I think that's sort of one of the bigger problems with a lot of horror franchises, when they try to go, you know, 4, 5, 6+ movies in, and now it's just about, oh, we're going to find out everything there is about this guy. We're going to make stuff up. And, like, they just fall apart. And we talked about this, James and I, on our last cast. Somehow we brought, like, Leprechaun in the hood. I think that was an example we were talking about.
Yeah, it's terrible.
What was that, James?
No, he's right. Yeah. He said it was terrible. I'm like, so bad.
Oh, were you about to say something, George?
I was just going to say, like, so many long-standing franchises happen to do that. I know, like, Nightmare on Elm Street, they kill him, then he comes back, and then finally in, like, part 7, they call it Freddy's Dead. And they're like, we promise he's dead now. And then, of course, there's, like, three other movies or something. There's two other ones. There's the new Nightmare that they made a couple years later, and then now they rebooted it, and now they're rebooting it again.
Yeah. And we said, again, like, Jason goes to hell. Jason goes into space. And I think that goes back to, again, with the horror genre with the video game, is that it's very hard to keep it up with multiple series. And I know, saying that, we're going to probably have a few wars to talk about with Five Nights at Freddy in a few minutes. But with, like, the mainstream horror games, even the ones that we talked about, like Silent Hill, they also started to run into, like, that series rot. Now, they did try to reinvent it several times. I know Shattered... Actually, that's a really good question for both of you. Did either of you play Silent Hill Shattered Memories?
Yep.
What about you, James?
No, I did not get a chance for that.
Okay.
I remember that coming out, and it didn't look like it captured the feel of the original.
Interesting.
It kind of actually turned me off.
Yeah, man, I'm sure George is going to have a comment about that. Just to frame it for those of you listening, Silent Hill Shattered Memories, it was actually the lead designer on that, I believe, was Sam Barlow, who I spoke to on the podcast, I think it was in 2015, who went on to make the critically acclaimed Her Story. And Silent Hill Shattered Memories, as James just said, it took a lot of different turns with it. It was more focused on puzzle solving than was about combat. Your only options were to run and hide for the most part from the creatures, and went with more of almost a choose your own story feel to it. But for you, George, what did you think of it?
I thought it was really innovative, and it did a lot of interesting things. Like, I was a huge fan of Eternal Darkness back in the day, so I felt like this was almost like a spiritual successor to that in certain ways, like the sequel I always wanted from that, because it went more in a psychological experimental space with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man.
Like it would even have like the psychological tests between levels, which I remember thinking like, okay, how's it gonna affect things? Like there was like one part where you had to color in something, and I spent maybe like an hour coloring it in,
yeah,
trying to think like, okay, what's it gonna say?
What's it gonna say about me when I finish this up? Yeah, and I agree. I thought it was very innovative. The only thing that, and it's not even like the game's fault, but I ran into a bug that caused me to lose like 2 hours of progress. And that just killed the game for me. But I thought it was a very interesting example. Again, it did the same thing with the older Silent Hills, with that pacing between normal and other Silent Hill. Now, another example, and I think this will probably be one of the last ones before we move on to talk about the State of Modern Horror. And this is another thing that James and I, we talked about on the previous cast, was the Condemned series. Did you play Condemned at all, George?
Yeah, I played both of them.
Yeah. Now, on the cast, we talked about as well, what did you make out of it, especially from like the horror side of things?
I thought that it really did it very well, because it felt very gritty. The environments were really, really well done, and the characters, too. Like, the art style really felt really realistic, and the fighting mechanics were just, like, brutal. And very, very real. So you had to get up into the enemy's faces and really go in at them. And so you never wanted to be that close to them. And they would run up to you really realistically. It was terrifying.
Yeah, and I really enjoy it. As we said on the cast, I think we all really loved the first game. The second one, I think, went a little too weird, I guess, in what they were trying to do with the storytelling. But yeah. I agree with you, George, about like the combat system. I thought that was a very great example of the player was, I guess, somewhat strong, but combat was still chaotic. It was gritty. It was, as you just said, it was very brutal as well.
Yeah, and I know what you mean about the second one, too. The second one, they introduced like a telepathic aspect to it. So that totally ruined everything, because the fear factor was about getting into close combat with these guys. And so when you're telepathic, you're just like a superhero.
Yeah. And as I said on the last cast, you basically became the chosen one with the voice of death, basically. You just like scream at people and they die.
Yeah.
All right. Before we move on then and talk about sort of the State of Modern Horror, which I'm sure will be our final and probably major topic for this cast, to sort of, I guess, transition over, I have, I guess, two questions, one for both of you and then one just for you, George. So, the first one, then, is for the group. We've sort of been hinting at this throughout the cast, but to frame it and wrap up the section. What would be your example of a game that you play, like, your favorite horror game? And what would be one that I think it missed for you, like, your least favorite? And we'll start with James this time.
Favorite horror game? Can it be survival horror?
Yeah, anything that can be considered, I guess, part of the horror genre.
Limbo. Limbo was kind of this tiny gem of horror. tiny gem of horror of things that you... I mean, it really had minor elements of horror in it, but I felt like those minor elements were so intimate that... It really stood out. That spider. And I'm not an arachnophobic. I even like spiders. I like spiders. But that spider was just no. That was just no. So I'd have to say, yeah, that one is definitely one that worked for me.
Okay. And what about one that didn't work?
One that didn't work. I don't know. I'd have to come back to that one. I can't really think of one right off the top of my head because my head right now is filled with that spider.
All right. So for you, George, what would be favorite horror experience and one that didn't work for you?
My favorite horror experience is Silent Hill 4. I know a lot of fans don't really like that one. There's a lot of contention about that one. Because that's right when Team Silent was kind of disbanded, and so only like there was Rikiri Yamaoka and somebody else, the other team was brought in to make this to start off as a different game, not really part of Silent Hill. But all that aside, though, that game was fantastic. It really, really made you feel powerless because there were these ghosts that you couldn't kill and they would just keep chasing you throughout this entire level until you decided to like stake them down and just peg them down to like a certain location. We only had a certain number of them throughout the entire game, so you can't even use them on all the ghosts. You had to pick and choose and maybe even like release a ghost and keep it for later. Mm-hmm. So that was terrifying, and the storyline was phenomenal. It really did some interesting things with I'm really into like the experimental, like things that happen differently with the games that you're not really expecting. So like coming back to the apartment and like going into a first person and like sort of like the safe haven, but it almost felt dreamlike then because they changed that perspective when you mm-hmm. came back to the apartment. It felt like you weren't playing the game anymore. It felt like, okay, now this is something else. Like it almost made it more realistic that way because it sort of had this barrier of perspective, this shift, I guess. So yeah, anyway, that's why I love it so much.
All right, and what would be like an example of the least favorite horror?
Least favorite horror is really hard to think of. It's like usually when you think of like a game that you don't want to, that you don't like or whatever, you don't want to play it. But like, I would say probably maybe Slender, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a one-note game. Yeah. I never finished it. And it was even disappointing with that one note, too, to be honest. But anyways, that's my calling.
For me, again, I think you all probably will know what I'm going to say. Favorite horror game would probably be Fatal Frame 3. And we don't have the time tonight to go into everything that I loved about that one. Least favorite, I think this will probably segue us into modern horror, would probably be like games like... I can tell you exactly. Amnesia, A Machine for Pigs. That game just fell apart for me in every possible way. Just did not enjoy it. Wasn't scared by it.
And I heard that.
What?
I heard that and I avoided that like the plague. Yeah. So, okay, go on. Sorry.
And like, it just... I didn't feel scared by it. I just felt annoyed playing it. And it would probably be... A real close runner-up would be Outlast, but to talk about that will take us into modern horror, and we'll definitely be bringing that up in the next few minutes. I just thought of one other horror game. I wanted to bring this up, but I can't remember the name of it, so maybe one of you will know it. It was a PlayStation 2 horror game. I think it was put onto the PlayStation 3, released in like an episodic format. It was about like Japanese horror...
Siren.
Thank you. That was that was one of those games that it goes back to what you were just saying, George, that it's kind of weird to talk about horror games that don't work or about games you don't want to play. Because like the point of horror is to scare you, like you're not supposed to want to play it. And Siren is one of those very weird games. Like the first time I played it, I hated it. I was like, you know, this sucks. I'm take it back to Blockbuster, you know, back during the Blockbuster days. I don't want to play this game, and then like few months later, I was like, you know, I want to see that game. I want to try it. So I actually rented it like a second time. What did you think of it, or did you have a chance to play it?
I had a very similar experience. I remember playing a demo of it. I played like a demo of it somewhere, or like I played at a friend's house, something like that. I had some sort of other introduction to it without having bought it like blindly. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, this is really interesting. I love the mechanic of it. And I felt like it was very, very, very difficult.
Yes.
So I got the game and like I never finished it. I even tried to go back to it years later, and I was like, okay, I'm much older now. I can do this. But no, oh my God, that game is one of the hardest games. It's probably the hardest horror game, I think.
Yeah. I know. Like I remember the part where you fight sniper rifle wielding zombies.
Oh,
that
yeah.
just. That's just evil right there. Did you ever get a chance to like play, or have you heard the game Siren before, James?
I've heard of it, never got a chance to play it. And thank God, I don't want to fight sniper.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Well, I mean, I guess they would be aiming for headshots.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a section where you're literally having to deal with zombies with sniper rifles who will like kill you instantly, like after like 3 seconds if they see you.
Yeah, it was so difficult, and they would even reuse environments or like levels. Mm-hmm. And you thought, okay, like I've been here before. This should be easier. Like I know this area, but no, it's still difficult.
It's not. So far we've been talking around the fact of modern horror games. I've been trying to ignore because I want to save it all, and it's finally time to talk about it. And that's going to move into probably one of our major, probably the second and final major topic for this cast, and that's the state of modern horror games. A few minutes ago, George brought up Slenderman. I was talking about Amnesia, Machine for Pigs, and modern horror, I think, has, again, the horror genre made that really big transition in the early thousands to action horror. And then we got this third transition, probably like over like the last 2-3 years, with this jump scare, or I think, George, you said this earlier in this cast, about like an entertainment side of horror, about being about focus on jump scares. And there's a whole lot to unpack about in this section. So to start it off, I guess let's go around. I'm sure George and I think I know how we're going to respond. So I'll start with you, James. What did you think, or if you've been looking at, like, sort of modern horror games? Stuff like Five Nights at Freddy's, Outlast, Slenderman, etc.
This is going to sound kind of, mean, but I kind of feel like a lot of those games really get their merits off on their fan bases as opposed to the actual quality and stick-to-itiveness of the horror genre.
Yeah.
Five Nights at Freddy's, I'll tell you the truth, Five Nights at Freddy's, from the just plain face value, it's just a jump scare game.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into deep stuff, and I know there's a lot of famous YouTubers who have done like lore videos and stuff, then you start realizing a little bit more of the actual horror, like more psychological aspects of behind some of this stuff. Like, and same thing with Slenderman. It's one of those things, just playing the Slenderman, you're like, oh, this is okay. Wow. Oh, I didn't know that was coming. But when you, I felt, yeah, again, it's the fan base and the lore behind all of the game that really gives it the psychological edge. And then at the same time, it's funny because I said this at one of the other casts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I can consider the game itself really horror then. I mean, I guess jump scare is horror, but it's not, I don't see it as being that substantial.
Yep, and as you were just saying, I think that draws parallels to our discussion on Dark Souls and how a lot of the storytelling is off of the actual game experience and how it's really left to the player to explore. And that's what we see a lot with these horror games like Amnesia, Slenderman, Outlast, and of course Five Nights at Freddy's. Like, I think what you were just saying, a lot of what made Five Nights at Freddy's famous wasn't really the game. It was more about the fans themselves. Like, I know, I think Markiplier pretty much rose up with his Five Nights at Freddy reaction videos.
Mm. Now, honestly, here's something really interesting, which I think some people have been really struggling to separate these two games. Mm-hmm. Dark Souls, it's a gothic, dark, action RPG.
Mm-hmm.
But Bloodborne is a gothic, dark action RPG as well, with horror elements thrown in and a lot of psychological and mm-hmm. Lovecraftian horror thrown in there, and even more so than Dark Souls. Dark Souls, there are things that you can't see, but most of it you can't see because of mechanics. You're just in a dark, poorly lit room for rightful purpose. But one of the things that I loved in the mechanics of Bloodborne, as opposed to Dark Souls, there were things you couldn't see, but not because of lighting, but because of a mechanic in the game called Insight, which you had to gain more of, which exposed things. So like there'd be things that would happen in the world that you would have no idea what, like there's a part, and spoilers for anybody, but there's a part where you get to a cathedral or a church, and if you walk too close to part of the church, suddenly you start to float in the air and all your blood squirts out of your head and you're dead. And you're like, what the, what? You're like, your brain is like, what the hell just happened? And you will never know what happens until you reach a certain point in the game, or you gain enough of a certain of that mechanic insight. Because once you gain a certain number of mechanical insight, now all of this stuff is actually told within the game too, so you don't have to go outside of it to look for, to understand what to do. If you get enough insight, you see an eldritch-like creature hanging off the side of this cathedral that you've gone in and out of 100 times, and that's the thing that's actually grabbing you. And it's one of the few instances in a game where it was a, you can't hurt it, you can't, you can shoot it all you want, it doesn't do anything, you can't talk to it, the only interaction you have with it is if you get too close, it picks you up and it kills you. And that's the first time in a game that I've seen that kind of Lovecraftian horror aspect. Not like this thing is actively killing, and it doesn't actively kill you. It's only if you go to a certain spot does it actually kill you. But you can't do anything about it. Heck, you can't even see it unless you actively try to seek it out and try to gain the level needed to. And that was kind of horrifying. That was scary. And that was something that I never got through the entire playthroughs of Dark Souls 1 and 2. You never got anything like that. There was nothing in the world that you couldn't interact with. You know, that didn't either actively try. Almost every enemy in the game is going to try to actively kill you. You know what I mean? And this thing didn't, which kind of freaked you out because you're thinking Dark Souls. You know, so that was a fun, that was a fun experience that I thought Bloodborne did a good job of separating itself horror-wise Bloodborne did from Dark Souls.
Yeah, and I think that what that's interesting that they did that too, because Dark Souls was designed very defensively, and like the designers even said with Bloodborne, they wanted people to not run and hide from combat. They wanted them to get in and really enjoy the combat. So that's why they developed that system where you could, if you got hit and you got a detriment taken from your health, and you can go back in and try and get a stab in and reclaim some health to encourage the combat. So it was more of an offensive game and not really trying to be terrifying in the game mechanics. Instead, they really focused on bringing the horror elements in through the art, and the narrative I felt was much darker than in Dark Souls.
Yes.
Like the art style in general and everything was just way more just horrific.
So for you, George, going back to talking about like the modern horror again, like the Five Nights, Slenderman, stuff like that, I know we talked about this briefly a few minutes ago in the previous section, but what is your take on sort of like the state of modern horror games?
I think that we're in a sort of going in a bad direction with that sort of aspect of it, the sort of jump scare entertainment show thing, where it's not really designed for the player so much as it's designed for people watching the player. But at the same time, though, I feel like we have a saving grace right now with that was PT, and with Resident Evil 7. With that demo thing, that they're trying to sort of bring it back to the survival horror, but still having that sort of fun, nobody knows what the heck is going on, how do you even finish this game kind of a feel, so that still encourages the YouTubers and the philosophizing YouTubers and the community around the game, but still bringing it back towards the horror elements, the atmosphere and everything that we like.
Yeah, and and on a previous cast, I had talked about Resident Evil 7. I feel like I'm generally excited about that game, and I think that's the first time I could say that about Resident Evil in a long time.
Yeah, me too.
And for me, obviously by now, for everyone listening, you should know, you should probably guess what I'm going to say, but yeah, I agree with you, George. I'm not a fan of what I'm seeing with these modern horror games. Earlier in this cast, I brought up Five Nights at Freddy's. I played, like, the first one, and I actually started to, like, doze off while playing it. And again, because it is just focused on jump scares, there's no other means of interaction, there's no other means of controls. It goes back to what we said earlier in this cast with, if you give the player too many options, it's just as bad as you give them too few options. What I was talking about with Amnesia: The Dark Descent. So with, like, Five Nights at Freddy's, once you... Those games really aren't... They don't lend themselves to a deep design, like, examination. They all really start to fall apart once you realize that it is about just events and just basic scripting of, oh, if you don't do this, you know, it's always going to cause this action.
Yeah, it's all, like, timers. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a matter of figuring out the timing of, like... And also, it's all kind of almost randomized. Most of them are randomized, too, mm-hmm. with when they will pop up. So, yeah, it's definitely takes the control away from the player. And then is it really even a game at that point? It's more of just a show.
Yeah.
Interactive movie, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and another thing, I think, going back to what James was saying in the last section... excuse me, regarding when the controls or the lore start to really, like, mess with your ability to get into the game. A lot of these jump scare focused games feature very arbitrary rules or mechanics to deal with. Like with the Five Nights, you have to always run to the door, make sure it's closed, always check the door, run back and forth, etc., etc. So it's very explicitly designed to do these things, and again, it's trying to force these jump scares and force you to always be on edge.
Yeah, so that eventually gets tiresome after mm-hmm. a while, and so there's no real room for a break to sort of cool off and really get engaged again. Instead, it sort of encourages you to sort of just distance yourself from it rather than pull you in. Mm-hmm. So you're not getting as scared anymore. You're sort of you're getting over it.
Yeah. And again, when there is no real control by the player, it just eventually, I think, breaks down. Like, going back to, like, Amnesia: The Dark Descent or Outlast, or even, there's this game I played a few months ago called Layers of Fear. It got to the point where I was like, okay, I'm going through another horror session. Let's just get through this. Oh, there's a scary noise. Okay. You know, it was just like, the game became routine.
I think a big part of that, too, is that you don't feel responsible. And mm-hmm. you have to feel responsible to get scared. You have to feel like I am responsible for this character, like this poor defenseless character. Like whatever happens to them is my fault, mm-hmm. and so you get scared from that too. If you don't have that, then it's like I just don't even care. Like mm-hmm. it's not my fault. I it's not my problem.
Yeah. Full investment. There's no investment into what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like, again, going back to the older horror games, when you get killed, like, you're dead. Like, you know, you get the big blood, you died on the screen in Resident Evil. Yeah. There were stakes, I think. There was an actual...
It really felt like failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, the fact that you can, like, sort of see this character in the world, you sort of get to understand them, like, the character becomes a major part of the game. Like, going back to Silent Hill 2... I think we all remember, like, James Sunderland and having him explore Silent Hill and sort of be confronted by his demons.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely, definitely. That was a huge part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And these modern games, there's no explanation given, or there's just, like, a very mm-hmm. short little blurb of, like, oh, you're playing this person who's here because of a job, or they're returning home.
And there's a ghost. That's it. And that's, Yeah, there's no real, like, investment into the situation because it's all focused, again, on the jump scares. On just, like, showing, you know, boo, someone just pops out and scares you, and that's the game.
That's extremely shallow.
Yeah.
Well, it's a Freddy's, your character doesn't have a name.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have a name. So you're basically like, okay, why am there's no investment. There's like, okay, well, what am I doing here?
Why should I even, why don't I just like get up and run the hell out the front door? Like, screw this job.
Yeah, wouldn't you quit after the first night?
Yeah. And I think that level of investment is a major part of, I think, where a lot of these modern horror games have failed. I had a really good example that I wanted to bring up, but I just lost it trying to bring it back. Let's see. Now I remember. And with the focus on jump scares, I think the other problem is that it's something similar that I see with actually the post that I'm working on right now regarding when the game is too random. And what happens is that when something is too random, I think the game becomes a little bit predictable. Because you always feel like you're always on the edge to expect the worst possible case. And taking that into the horror genre, when your entire game is built on jump scares, it really lessens like what the player can do, what you can actually test the player on. As you just said a few minutes ago, George, regarding like Five Nights at Freddy's, the whole series is built around like these timers and scripted situations. So they can't really give you varied gameplay because it's all about if you fail, there's a jump scare. If you don't wind up the music box in Five Nights at Freddy's 2, there's a jump scare. If you press the button the wrong time, guess what? There's a jump scare, etc., etc.
And those things are also, you figure them out from trial and error.
Yeah.
Like, there's no rational explanation for those things.
Mm-hmm. And like they lose a lot in terms, again, of pacing and I guess bringing the player into the environment. Like we brought this up earlier, but like examples of Condemned or Silent Hill or even Resident Evil were examples of where the environment becomes a part of the experience because you have to actually explore it. And I think sort of as the main point of the section, you have to engage with the experience.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's crucial, really.
Now, I didn't bring this up in the last section. I know it's a little late, but I just wanted to ask quickly, as an example of like a modern attempt at sort of the old school horror, there was The Evil Within from, I think it was 2014. What did you think of that one, or if you had a chance to play it?
Yeah, I played it. I love that game. I thought it was really, really awesome. I thought it was like a really good blend of Resident Evil with Silent Hill, in a way. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like it took elements from both, because it had that sort of home environment and the surreal nature of Silent Hill.
Yeah.
And then it also had the Resident Evil 4 type of over-the-shoulder combat type of like shooting type of thing going on for it.
Yeah.
But I think it really did a good job. Yeah, well, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I actually, every time I bring up, I still feel remiss I haven't played it yet. And I think maybe this weekend I may just break down, finally install it on my computer. James, did you play The Evil Within at all?
No, and it's funny because like I was listening intently to what he was saying about it because I've heard a lot of good things about it. And I'm kind of in your boat, Josh, where I was one of those, I want to get it, but I hate to say it, but because of a lot of the state of modern horror games, I feel like I've already gotten all I've wanted out of the old horror games, and I haven't seen anything new. And
sorry, go on.
Oh no, please go on.
I was just gonna say, like, yeah, you with Evil Within, it doesn't really do anything new. I guess that's one thing I should say about that. Like, it does the old stuff well, and it picks the good from both genres, from both series, and it does it very well. But at the same time, though, you're aware that it's just copying things. Like, for example, there's the guy with the box in his head instead of pyramid head. He's a direct ripoff of that. But yeah, it doesn't really do anything new and noteworthy for it. It won't stand the test of history.
It's not going to be as memorable as probably like Silent Hill or the original Resident Evils.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think that's what I think a lot of people did ding it on as well. And one other example of a modern attempt at this kind of classic horror, I know I brought this up a few minutes ago, I think you also had some comments on it too, George, was Alien Isolation. And I thought that it had a really brilliant mechanic with the alien being just always in your face, but I think we both agree that, again, when it's always in your face, it kind of, again, it can only last or sustain horror for so long.
Yeah, Exactly. And so that kind of got a little tiresome after a while. But there was a skill involved with that, which was really good. Like, you had a defensive skill that you could sort of master with the flamethrower. If you could master that, then you're fine. And it took a while to master that and figure that out. So that was actually really well done, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, with modern horror itself, I think, again, going back to what we've been saying over the last few minutes, I think one of the bigger problems is that it all starts to really blur together. Like, I'm not seeing anything different in Outlast that I saw in Amnesia. And Five Nights at Freddy's has become sort of the template for a lot of these horror games that we're seeing these days. And I think one of the things that really annoys me, and goes back to sort of this jump scare focus, is that if you spend like even like a minute looking like horror mechanics, you realize that all the ways it's designed around the jump scares, because you're dealing with these static scenes, you always have to look away. You start to realize, okay, I know, you know, I turn around, turn back, I'm going to get scared. And again, it just loses the mystique when you're able to peer behind the curtain, in a sense.
Yeah, and I think that there is a better way to do jump scares. I'm not advocating jump scares. I think they're cheap. But I remember years and years ago, in the age of internet flash games, when they were like the heyday of them, I guess, with Newgrounds and all that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's still around, but there were jump scare games back then that were very popular. Point and click ones. I think one of them was called Ex Mortis or Ex Mortem, something like that. And that one handled it very well, because you would explore the environment, and you'd like open up a microwave, and there'd be a head in the microwave, and it would flash the head at you, and it would be like kind of scary. But like, that was something that you've sort of found, and it would be very shocking for the character that's exploring this place to like, you know, see that. So that one, I think, did it very well. But then that was also around that time was the start of the sort of prank jump scares, which I think is where Five Nights at Freddy's and those types of games come from. They don't really, they sort of come off as almost like prank type things, where you're watching or playing for somebody else's amusement. Like the maze game. Do you remember the maze game where you think it's just like a game where you're exploring a maze? It was just like an old flash game, and then it would pop up like the Exorcist face at you.
Oh yes, I do remember. I remember that.
So that's like a thing that just got like passed around, and it was like a prank, or just for the amusement of the person watching you play.
Yeah.
And I think that's where these things are coming from, where it's just like the amusement of watching the people playing,
rather than actually the person playing it having like a detailed or involving experience.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that's another, that also lends itself into a greater discussion about sort of the rise of the YouTuber generation. But I think that is something that is a bit too big. We need to, one of these days, James, I think that's another topic we need to have a dedicated podcast to, and sort of about how the YouTube has really become a major facet of the game industry. Now, what I was about to say regarding that is that so many of these horror games, or at least the modern horror ones, again, they lend themselves more to watching, sort of like you're watching a horror movie. But there's just not really good examples of these games like engaging the player. Like, again, like I tried watching a few videos of Markiplier when he does the Five Nights at Freddy's series, and like the first was like, okay, it's tense, and then by the time you get to like even like watching him play it, when you get to like his like third or fourth video on these games, like he doesn't even like react at all anymore to them. And it's just really telling about what these, like the limits of these games.
Mm-hmm. They're good they're good for that one thing. They're good for that one jump scare.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then it's like, oh, I know what this is already. So.
Yeah, and then again, as we said, like you can't sustain that for more than a few minutes when it's just all jump scare focus.
Yeah, and it's also the same type of jump scare, too.
Yeah.
Like, it's the same scenario, the same situation where they would pop up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, and I think so far we've had a really great discussion. It's been fascinating, again, to return to the horror genre. As I said at the beginning of this cast, the last time I did was like 3-4 years ago, so I've been itching to have this kind of talk again. And I feel like we could really talk for another hour or so about it, and there's still probably a discussion we have about like modern cinema horror as well. I would love to have a discussion on that, maybe with you again, George, but I know we are getting a little bit late, so it's probably time to start to wrap it up.
Yeah, I would enjoy doing that talk too in the future.
Definitely. So, to wrap up talking about modern horror, and then I have one final question. Here's my big question regarding modern horror, and I want to go around the room again. So, this time we'll start with you, George. The question is, over the last almost hour and a half, we've talked about past horror. We talked about the transition to action horror, and we spent the last 20 or so minutes talking about jump scare horror. So, in your opinion, I guess, where do you see, or where would you like to see horror go to next?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think, well, like with PT and Resident Evil 7, the demo at least that we've seen, I think that's where I would like to see it going, where, especially with PT, where there's just like this elements of mystery where it's like, did I find everything? Did I see everything that I could have saw, that I solve everything, because there's like so many like little Easter egg type things or ways to solve the puzzle. For example, like the whole waiting for the phone to ring and then waiting for the baby to cry. Like that thing was like a little, it was so like arbitrary, but it was interesting to see the community come together and like trying to figure out what the rumors were of how to solve it. I think that's where the future is, the community around these like incredibly convoluted puzzles.
Okay. And for you, James?
I really would like to see what would happen if... and it's funny, kind of attaches to what we were talking about before. I'd love to see what Telltale does with a horror, just does with horror. I don't know if I'd say give them a licensed franchise. Maybe give them a licensed franchise. Maybe they do their own franchise, licensed title. I'd love to see what Telltale could do. Mainly because I think some of the best horrors are where the player has little to no control over what's going on. And they basically just have to survive in a horrific world. Where you could have all the best elements of jump scare, all the best elements of psychological horror, maybe even add a couple of action scenes in there. You know what they've done with the Walking Dead game was amazing. That was more about story drama as opposed to horror, and I think it would only take a couple of shifts and an original story to really give a really good horror experience through the way they do games.
Interesting. And I think that could be a different route for Telltale to go. Again, we talked about this on last week's cast and about how Telltale's really been moving away from the adventure genre, but that could be something as an interesting alternative for them. For me, I would like to see, I think a lot of what George was saying regarding that mystery element. I want to see more like the adventure and more of the thought that goes into like the horror. Again, for going back to the days where we had that sense of pacing, where it wasn't just about all combat all the time or all passive all the time. The design diamond that I wrote would probably be a good example of that. And again, I want to see, like, fight or flight. Like, I want the player to have the option, but not be 100% on. I want to see more of, like, the thinking that goes back into horror. Like, something similar to Alien Isolation, where you have these threats where you can only mitigate them. You can't permanently stop them. And I think that would be another interesting route to go. And again, like with Resident Evil 7, I would like to see, again, how that really plays out with part adventure, part horror, and then part like that PT, you know, there's just a grand mystery, you have no idea what's going on kind of feel.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. All right. I know we are getting late. It's about dinner time for me, so it's time to wrap things up. And with that, I have just a few more quick questions, and this will go back to when wounds bloom for you, George. So, my first question then is, since you've been working on the game, do you have, like, an idea of when you're hoping to put it out, or, like, what's your plan, like, the next few months?
My plan is to finish up the demo that I've got going. I just want to, like, polish it up, add some, like, voice acting, really make it look nice for a Kickstarter that hopefully happen by the end of the year. And then, like, the timeline for the development would be hopefully by October of 2017 to finish it.
Okay. Are you planning on going to any crowdfunding platforms like Indiegogo or Kickstarter?
Yeah. I was saying that I'm looking towards okay. Kickstarter. Indiegogo possibly too. But Kickstarter is like the main one that everybody knows about. So I feel like that'd be easier to promote. Mm-hmm. Hopefully within a month or so hitting up the Kickstarter and by then having the demo available so that you can give it a try first and then see if you like it and then hopefully back it.
Cool. And definitely keep in touch regarding that. I would love, as we were saying a few minutes ago, regarding talking about modern horror or the film side of things, I would love to have you back on. We can maybe time it around the Kickstarter and work that into the discussion as well.
That would be perfect.
Awesome. Alright, I think with that, I'm about out of questions. James, do you have any questions or any you'd like to bring up about horror or talk to George about?
No, I think this is a great cast. Love to have him back, actually.
Great.
Awesome, thanks.
Alright, so, again, with the horror genre, there's still so many more facets to talk about. I feel like I still have, like, 5-10 more questions we could probably spend another hour on. But as I said, it's getting late here. I need to go get something to eat. And I think it's time to wrap it. I think all of our voices are sufficiently parched. We are recording this. It's like, I think it's like 98 degrees or 100 degrees here right now.
Yeah, same here in California.
Yeah. So it is time to wrap things up. So as always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to submit a guest piece of the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links on the front page under Submissions Wanted. We are always looking for new guests, be them students, enthusiasts, designers. As long as you're interested in talking with us, we'd love to have you on. If you'd like to support the Game Wisdom Patreon campaign in order to get the monthly funding we need to keep going, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking the banner on the front of the website. You'll be able to look at the goals we have up. If we can hit them, I'll be able to add more content. And this will also be your way if you would like to get a digital CD featuring each month's cast, including a commentary track from me. You can find all that on the Patreon site. You can follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer, where you'll get the latest updates when content goes live. And lastly, you can find me on YouTube under the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, where you'll find my collection of Let's Plays, video examinations, and more. So, with all that said, George, again, it was a pleasure hanging out with you this evening, and I do wish you the best of luck with When Wounds Bloom. It's always great to hear someone trying to recapture the magic of older horror games, so good luck with that.
Thank you.
And James, again, it was great hanging out with you. I think you're really enjoying these casts, and it was also great getting your thoughts on the horror genre, because, again, you missed the first cast we had on that.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. I had a great time, and definitely best of luck for you too, George.
Thanks.
Awesome. So, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast this week. Have a great rest of the week, and we will see you all next time with another great discussion. Take care.